Our next speaker is Colleen Sabatini. She's the head of pediatric orthopedics at Auckland UCSF. But she also travels to Uganda and has spent 5 years spending about 6 weeks a year there. She would like to spend longer. And prior to that, she has experience in the Dominican Republic and Nepal. So Colleen is going to share with us some pearls from a pediatric orthopedic surgeon to a general surgeon.
Good afternoon. Oh, wow. Man, general surgery is rougher than orthopedics. Usually I get an answer. Good afternoon. Okay, that was a little something. It's my job to make sure everybody's awake out there. So I'm Colleen Sabatini. I'm speaking to you as an orthopedic surgeon. So I'm going to try to teach you in 15 minutes everything I know about bones. How many of you out there operate on bones on a regular basis? Excellent. So I got a couple brethren out there. I do not have any financial disclosures. First and foremost, I want to acknowledge the orthopedic surgical team at Korsu Rehabilitation Hospital in Kasubi, Uganda, where I've been working over the last few years, particularly Drs. Loro and Muhumuza, who are dear friends and colleagues, as well as my mentor, Dr. Penny, who's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon from University of British Columbia and helped me get my start in Uganda. And I do want to acknowledge the AO Foundation and draw your attention to the AO Foundation, because if you're doing any global work, the AO Foundation has excellent online resources for people who are not familiar with orthopedics. Musculoskeletal conditions that you might encounter working in a least resource-limited area are certainly different than what you might experience in the United States, particularly in the United States, since orthopedic surgeons take care of most musculoskeletal problems. But in many countries, particularly resource-limited ones, general surgeons are providing the vast majority of the critical orthopedic care because there are not sufficient orthopedic surgeons to do so. So you might see a range of problems such as traumatic injuries, both in children and adults, infection, particularly chronic osteomyelitis, which is really a non-entity in the United States, pediatric deformities, both angular deformities from nutritional deficiencies as well as acquired problems, as well as congenital deformities like clubfoot. Certainly there's advanced musculoskeletal oncologic problems from untreated tumors, which ultimately can result in limb amputation or death, and spine deformities and degenerative conditions. Really what we're going to focus on today is traumatic injuries and infection, because that's where you can save lives and limbs. And the other things really are probably better left untreated by people who are not skilled in pediatric orthopedics. So our goals for today are to talk about infection and trauma, because that's what you're most likely to confront and what you're most likely to be able to help with, chronic osteomyelitis, open fracture management, basic fracture management, and compartment syndrome, all in the next 13 minutes. So here's our first patient, a four-year-old girl who presents with several months of left arm pain and drainage. This leads us to look at those x-rays, which you can see show an abnormality of the bone here, significant deformity of the joint, and some sinuses draining. So this is osteomyelitis. Osteomyelitis, of course, is infection of the bone. It is spread either hematogenously by a transient bacteremia that then takes root in bone, or via direct inoculation from trauma to the bone or surgery. It is very common, particularly in children, much more so than adults. In children, they have these venous sinusoids, which are in the metaphyses of the long bones adjacent to the physis. And in those areas, there's vascular sludging, and the bacteria that's transiently going through the bloodstream can leave the vessels and go into the bone and take root. Children with an acute osteomyelitis will present with localized pain, fever, lethargy, and a refusal to bear weight, if it's a leg or refusal to use the limb. If you have labs available, we tend to get a CBC with differential, which will show a leukocytosis and an elevated overall white blood cell count, an ESR, a CRP, and blood cultures. And increasingly, even in resource-limited areas, some of these are available. In acute osteomyelitis, these are helpful. In chronic osteomyelitis, where there's bone coming out of skin, they're not really that necessary. And when you're talking about making sure you're using your resources appropriately, sometimes you don't need labs to prove that there's an infection. If it's acute and not chronic, then you can treat with antibiotics. If it's diagnosed early, and that can prevent our long-term complications. If osteomyelitis goes untreated, then you get this collection of bacteria in the metaphysis, for example, of a bone. It then starts to kill that bone as a process of necrosis occurs. That then creates a further nidus for infection. So more and more bacteria, more and more infection develop in the metaphysis. Ultimately, the pressure builds up and it has to break out of that bone. So it violates the cortex and enters the subperiosteal space. That infection then builds. There's an abscess forming in that subperiosteal space, stripping the periosteum off the bone, which is its blood supply. Bone without periosteum dies, and so then you have an even larger area of dead bone. Dead bone begets more dead bone because the infection worsens over time. Ultimately, that subperiosteal abscess becomes quite large, and you get this area of bone inside that's basically dead. You have a subperiosteal abscess, which is getting larger over time, and then you have the body trying to heal and wall off that abscess by forming an involucrum, which is new bone. So involucrum and sequestrum are important words to remember as we go through this process. For chronic hematogenous osteomyelitis, it's important to know it's different than post-traumatic osteomyelitis in adults. Kids have a better periosteal response, better remodeling, and better healing potential. This is a catabolic disease, so the children are malnourished, they're anemic, and they definitely require nutritional support. So if you can do anything for these children, even before you touch them with anything surgical, it's to make sure you're optimizing their nutrition. If you optimize their nutrition, they have a chance of healing. This is a walled off infection. It has to be treated surgically. The strategy is to remove the dead bone because dead bone is bad. And if you can remove the dead bone, then the child can heal pretty much the infection even without antibiotics once that nidus is gone. If they have systemic symptoms, so if they're febrile, if they're systemically ill, then we would treat with antibiotics. So again, reviewing our anatomy, sequestrum, this is the original native ulna here and it has basically died. So this is an area of dead bone, which is called the sequestrum, within this larger area of bone around it, which is the involucrum, which is what the body formed to try to heal and wall off this area. You can see maybe that there's an area of lucency here and an area of lucency here. Those are the cloacas where the sequestrum pressure has built up. It's broken through the involucrum. That pus has poured out of that, through that cortex, and ultimately then out the skin in the form of these sinus tracts. So if we're gonna go in and treat that, we're gonna go through the steps of that. So if it was acute, we're gonna treat with antibiotics. This is the slide to remember. If there's a chronic infection with a sequestrum and no open wound, and the involucrum is underdeveloped, do not do anything. Wait until your involucrum develops, okay? Because if you go in and you take dead bone out, but there's no good bone there, you've just rendered the limb completely unstable, and that is a non-salvageable limb. So if there's no urgency, let the involucrum develop. If, however, it's a chronic infection and the sequestrum is being expressed, like it's actually coming out of the skin, which we'll see some pictures of, or there's draining sinuses, then if the involucrum is fully developed, just take out the sequestrum. If the involucrum has not developed fully, then you have to do an external fixator with a sequestrectomy. And at no point in the setting of infection do we put internal hardware in. You all know we love our open reductions internal fixations, but if there is infection, we do not do any internal fixation. So here's our patient again. We're gonna go in, we find our sinus tract. That sinus tract will take us right to our sequestrum. That will help us localize where our incision can be. You can see that sequestrum, so there's pus coming out of her arm, so you know you're in the right place. This is the sequestrum being removed. This is what a sequestrum looks like. And on x-ray, you could see that there were some additional pieces. It's very important to make sure you go back in and you take out all of the pieces of sequestrum or else you're not gonna heal the infection. And then ultimately you do an extensive irrigation and debridement through that area. And this is actually like a gauze going through those two cloacas and like wringing it out, making it clean. All right, here's another patient, a 12-year-old boy. Very obviously a chronic osteomyelitis. That's his tibia coming out of his leg. If you look at our x-ray here, we have this sequestrum here, so the dead piece of tibia, and a very well-developed involucrum. So we have a sequestrum coming out of the body with a well-developed involucrum. We can basically just go in and take that out. And that's what happened here. No need for stabilization, just an irrigation, and really no need for antibiotics in that situation. Here's a different story. This is a 2-year-old male who presented obviously with a very swollen, painful left thigh, very lethargic, ill appearing. This is his x-ray. So here you have a sequestrum. This entire length of the medullary canal of the femur is dead. So this is all sequestrum. This is all subperiosteal abscess, and this is the involucrum that's trying to develop. Okay, so we have a sequestrum and a child who's very ill with a huge amount of abscess burden. So this needs to be drained, but we do not have a stable involucrum. So we're gonna go to the OR, we're gonna decompress that abscess. Yes, that is pus pouring into a bowl. And you can see how his thigh changed from that decompression. And then ultimately, then we do an external fixator, and we'll, if we have time, we'll talk a minute about external fixators, because that is something that, as a general surgeon working in a resource-limited environment, that it's important to have in your armamentarium. So you can see here that there's a spanning external fixator that was placed. It actually goes into the sequestrum, because the sequestrum is not ready to be removed. We can actually use it to help us in this situation. So temporizing for 4 weeks, you can see that's where the abscess was drained. Ultimately went back in 4 weeks later, there's enough of an involucrum now to give the external fixator enough to work with, so we can take out the sequestrum and then shorten the length of the external fixator. And then 1 month later, again, fully, you can start to see a full development of an involucrum that then matures over the next 2 months. And this is the amazing power of kid bone to heal, particularly when it's not sitting next to something dead. So you see this amazing involucrum develop, the external fixator is removed, and the child is both walking and moving both the hip and the knee. A different technique we can see when we have these walled off abscesses, so not a clear sequestrum, but sort of the entire length of the long bone is involved. In these situations, we do a procedure called saucerization, where you go in, you actually take off the anterior cortex of the long bone, and that's called canoeing. And then with that front of the bone off, you then can debride the whole intermedullary canal and make sure you take out any microabscesses that are there. And then you actually lay the muscle into that canoe, because the muscle brings blood flow to that bone and it helps with healing. Okay, so this is saucerization, and a very important technique to be familiar with when you have a large area of involved long bone. And in the interest of time, we shall keep going. These are closed loosely. Of course, you don't want to close an infection tight. If you have drains, you can use them, but most of the time we don't have them available. You can do simple drains with Penroses or gauze. Again, antibiotics are not always necessary, so don't use them if you don't have to. And certainly in adults, we talk about the use of antibiotic beads, but that has not been shown to be necessary in children. So when you're planning for your sequestrectomy or your saucerization, the whole goal is to preserve structural bone. You want to approach through the weakest area, which is the sinuses and the cloaca, and make sure to remove all sequestral fragments. And just a note on septic arthritis, so infected joints need to be washed out. If you have infection in a joint and that doesn't get washed out, you will lose that joint over time. So this is a destroyed knee. This is clearly a destroyed hip. These are untreated septic infections. And when you have a osteomyelitis in a metaphyseal area where that metaphysis is interarticular, you're at a markedly increased risk of having a septic joint. So the hip is at risk because the proximal femur is interarticular. The shoulder is at risk because the proximal humerus is interarticular. Same thing with the wrist because of the radius, and the ankle because of the tibia. It's helpful to know basic approaches to the joints. The most complicated one is the surgical approach to the hip, and this is how we would do it in orthopedics. So a short oblique incision distal to the anterior superior iliac spine. You go in the interval between the tensor fasciae lat and the sartorius, being careful of the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve. That's the most important part of that surgery, is to not bag that nerve and cause a long-standing nerve problem, neuritis in that area. Or neuroma. You go through the deep interval, which is between the rectus femoris and the gluteus medius, and you come right down onto the anterior capsule of the hip. We clear that off with a cob or a peanut. You make a 1 cm by 1 cm capsulotomy in that anterior hip joint, and basically that creates an opening. The pus comes out, you irrigate the heck out of it, and then you can put a small drain in. You do not close the capsule, right? So that's its egress. You leave that capsule open and allow the pus to pour out if it reaccumulates, which hopefully it does not. Ankles, knees, elbows are a lot easier to get into. And last couple of minutes, we're going to talk about open fractures. Everybody should be familiar with the Castillo-Anderson classification, which is how we categorize open fractures. The single most important thing is to remember that not all limbs are salvageable, but many are. And the absolute critical step of open fracture management is to make sure that they get antibiotics right away. So the most important predictor of outcome in open fractures is that antibiotics are administered within 3 hours of injury. The surgical timing then is within 24 hours for washout, and obviously anything more, vascular injury is more emergent. When you talk about antibiotics, your first generation cephalosporins are all you need for the smaller openings, so ones and twos. The bigger openings, so greater than 10 centimeters, you would add a gentamicin or other aminoglycoside. And then importantly, particularly in resource limited areas where lots of the population lives in more farm type areas, we do worry about Clostridia perfringens, and so we would treat with penicillin and always make sure that the tetanus of your patient is up to date, which certainly can be a problem in a resource limited environment. The goal is to get them initially managed as best as possible. So your trauma survey and resuscitation are critical. Make sure those antibiotics get in, and then control your bleeding with direct pressure. We all know that we shouldn't place tourniquets unless we're actually trying to save the life, because doing so might lose the limb. Make sure you fully assess your situation in terms of neurovascular injury and the surrounding joints. Clean and dress the wound, removing all the gross debris that's there, but do not take out the bone. And then stabilize, because a arm or a leg that's injured that's not stabilized is going to have more soft tissue injury and increase the risk of compartment syndrome. And you'll also get worse vascular clotting if you don't support the limb. So you're going to go to the OR, to your formal IND, debride any devitalized tissue. And remember that kids bounce back a lot more than adults, so do not do aggressive debridements on children. We tend to close in a delayed fashion. Fracture management is critically important. You should know basics of splinting, of traction pin placement, and that's both for the arms and for the legs. And then principles of external fixation are going to be critically important as well. So you should, before you're going to go work in a least resource limited environment, talk to your local orthopedic surgeon, have them set you up with the orthopedic rep in the area, and do some hands-on sawbones exercises with external fixators so you become familiar with these. The technique is really basic, and you can definitely learn this and have this in your skill set. And then finally, compartment syndrome is something to always remember. The most important finding clinically in compartment syndrome is pain with passive range of motion. And that if you have pain with passive range of motion and all of the other P's that you're familiar with, then we need to go to the operating room and do a decompression of those compartments. So the forearm is released through a single volar incision, and the lower leg is treated mostly with a two-incision technique if you're not familiar with one-incision technique. And then the important thing is to make sure that these get closed in a timely manner. And that is all.